Call the committee to order. Today's Monday, the 26th of April, 2004. It's now about 6 minutes after the hour of 8 a.m. Have Senator Ogden, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins. That constitutes a quorum. We're going to go ahead and get started. First on our calendar this morning is Senate Bill 388. This is a very short packet. Let me just give you a little bit of a rundown on 388. This 388 sets up a fund called the Civil Legal Services Fund. That fund says that the legislature may appropriate to the fund the amount deposited into the general fund of the state under AS 09-17-020J, which is punitive damages. Punitive damages awards in the state of Alaska are split 50% to the state, 50% to the prevailing party. So that was a result of, I think, Scott, Senator Ogden, you were here when they passed the tort reform bill, and when was that, 97, 98, somewhere in there?
Yeah.
And it basically allows the legislature to appropriate money from those punitive damages to this fund to help fund civil legal services to low-income individuals in the state. It's a pretty worthwhile goal. It's one that I support pretty strongly. I've seen it be used effectively. The people that are over there are not taking frivolous lawsuits cases, but are used in many cases where people who do not have the means or the method to be able to pursue a legitimate claim any other way have been able to do so.
Chair.
Senator Ogden.
Does this mean an unemployed legislator would be able to afford legal services?
You may be able to get legal services.
I don't know if we're below poverty level or not, but I just wondered.
If this is your only job, you might qualify.
I want to clear my conflict.
So, all right. Yes. Do we have anyone that wanted to testify on this bill this morning? Have Andy Harrington from on the off net. Andy, you are with us on the off net. Are you there?
Yes, Senator Deacon. Thank you. This is Andy Harrington. I'm down in Anchorage today for some bar convention this week, but I'd be happy to talk to you for just a couple seconds and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Go right ahead, Andy. You're on the record.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate the Judiciary Committee being willing to consider this bill and allowing the opportunity for me to talk about it a little bit. Alaska Legal Services, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, we're a private nonprofit organization that provides civil legal assistance to low-income Alaskans. We don't do criminal cases. We don't represent people who are charged with a crime. We handle cases in which, for example, a tenant might be faced with a possible loss of shelter. A working family is faced with a loss of income through a garnishment or attachment of their wages. Or a domestic violence victim is faced with further victimization or trying to navigate the legal system to obtain some protection or get a divorce or a custody order or something like that. When there is a legal defense or a legal argument that can be raised on behalf of these people, our attorneys thrive on helping people understand that and going to court and trying to make the case for them. We also have a considerable community education component. We, for example, we have a pilot project with a legal learning lab in Fairbanks, in which we're trying to help people learn how to use computers to do their own legal research and understand court system procedures that way. We have a website specifically dedicated to that purpose, AlaskaLawHelp.org, that has several subject matter areas designed to help people who are most likely to be trying to represent themselves in the court system without an attorney. We brought this idea up as a suggestion of the court system. We had been working with the court system on the possibility of a civil filing fee surcharge. But after a conference with the court system said, we don't like the idea of the surcharge so much, but we think this might be a good idea for you to pursue. So we're, we think the court system has good ideas, and B, we like to get along with the court system. So we are pursuing this, and we appreciate the committee's willingness to consider that. And with that,
Okay, are there questions for Mr. Harrington?
I'll wait till we hear from Mr. Bundy.
Okay. Well, if you'll hang tight there, Andy, we may, after we hear from Mr. Bundy, we may have some more questions. So, Mr. Bundy, if you're there, if you'd put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator. I preface this by saying I've been practicing law here for 32-some years now, and all the many places from Nome to Anchorage to various other places around the state. And I want to bring out something about the things that Legal Services does that people don't often hear about or see. And it has to do with allowing the court system and the laws to function really more smoothly. There's nothing more aggravating representing a client than having an unrepresented person that you're dealing with that really has no understanding of the law and no understanding of procedure, and creates a much more of a bottleneck in the court than otherwise. What Legal Services does often, and when they have offices, particularly in places in the bush, and especially here in Anchorage, our banks, you know, is oftentimes a lot of people that perceive that they have a horrible legal problem can get some advice that they otherwise have to pay for that they can't afford, that makes them understand what their legal situation is and allows them to deal with it in a way that doesn't use up their resources and the resources of everybody else fighting some sort of a battle that doesn't need to be fought. Second, the Legal Services provides the assistance for people that can't afford it to get through the ordinary things in life that are important from a legal standpoint that most people can't afford. Things like adoptions, and there's a lot of that in the bush and a lot of that in Anchorage and the other urban areas in Alaska. The ordinary divorces, child custody disputes, all of those things that have to be taken care of through the legal system and really can't be taken care of too many other ways. And if they're not taken care of, can create gigantic problems later on that are just more expensive and more time consuming for everybody. So in addition to representing people in court cases where there's a real a fight at stake, Legal Services does a lot just to make sure that people in our society have the legal advice and representation to get through the ordinary things in life that just make the whole system function better. I think right now, because of the squeeze on revenues everywhere, it's getting harder and harder for Legal Services to provide these kinds of important things, particularly in places in the bush, but also in the bigger towns in Alaska, Anchorage, Fairbanks, you know. And for people to come in and have long waiting lines kind of discourages the use that they need to make of the service available. And finally, I just want to say that the bang for the buck is unbelievable. The lawyers of Legal Services work much for much less than any other lawyers you'll find in the state, and especially including people that are actually state employees. These people work for a little bit, they're dedicated, they care about their clients, and they just do a real good job. I think this is a really worthwhile bill if there's some way to get some money to this group of people to keep this going on.
Thank you. Senator French, you had questions for the gentleman?
Question for either Mr. Bundy or Mr. Harrington. My question is this. What level of state funding are you getting right now? And are you concerned at all that this vehicle, which may or may not actually add something to Alaska Legal Services state funded budget, are you concerned that this bill may, you know, serve as a proxy for that funding? That is, folks will think this bill provides money to the Legal Services Corp, and therefore we don't actually need to put any real dollars in there. We'll just rely on this bill as a mechanism for providing funding.
Thank you. Our current level of funding from the state for the current fiscal year is $125,000. That amount is down over the past 20 years. 20 years ago, Alaska Legal Services was getting an appropriation of about $1 million from the state, so it has gone down drastically over the intervening 20 years. And as a matter of fact, this year it went down from $175,000 last year to $125,000 currently. Right now, that $125,000 is for next year has been approved by the House. It's not included in the Senate budget, so we're in the position of waiting on the conference committee to try to figure out whether or not the programs, employees, offices that we want to make sure we have in place. dedicated program revenue, we don't know how much money there is in this that comes to the state. We've been trying to do, but a little research we were able to do indicated that it was less than $100,000 over a 9-month period of time. And that was the best information we could come up with. I don't know whether less than $100,000 means $5.39 or whether it means $99,000, but if it's, and it could be very much a roller coaster from year to year. So I guess the bottom line is, yes, we are worried, I guess, that this might replace state appropriation, but given the difficulties we've had with the state appropriation, we think this is a better course for us to be pursuing, as the court system has suggested.
Andy, I appreciate that. I think many members share the intent as a good intent, and don't aim for this to supplant state support, but to try to maybe enhance it would be a better word. So, and again, it is going to be an interesting fund because this bill basically says the legislature may appropriate. It doesn't say that it shall, but it may. And so we'll have a way to at least apply some leverage and some stronger discussion than just to having it get lost somewhere in the subcommittee discussions. Okay, other questions for these gentlemen? Seeing none, do we have anyone else online that would like to testify on this bill? And do we? No? And do we have anyone from the audience that would like to testify on the bill today? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and we'll just take a short recess so we can get our members back. Back on the record, we've closed public comment. Is there any further discussion among the members?
My concerns were addressed by the head of the Alaska Legal Services, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Entertain a motion to move this bill on to the Finance Committee for their consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill Number 388 with attached zero fiscal note and ask for individual records.
Is there objection? Hearing none. 388 is moved to the Finance Committee. Thank you. And we'll move now to House Bill Number 188. Representative Hawker, welcome to the Judiciary Committee this morning.
Thank you, Senator.
I see you're the erstwhile sponsor here, so we'll certainly pay attention to your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate that very much. This bill, House Bill 188, is a bill that I introduced at the request of the downhill ski industry in Alaska. This bill, the purpose of it is to complete the implementation of the Alaska Ski Safety Act, which was passed by the 18th legislature back in 1994. I kind of note for the record that my co-sponsor on this bill is Representative Beth Curtula, whose father is the person who carried the original Ski Safety Act back in 1994, when he also represented much of the area that I now represent, including the Alyeska Ski Resort. The Alaska Ski Safety, in 1994, it was recognized that downhill skiing as an industry is something that Alaska had a great opportunity to develop, certainly a major part of our developing a winter tourism activity up here and continuing efforts to expand our economy, as well as something that certainly most Alaskans value the sport. And it was an issue that was, or perhaps arguably maybe it ought to be, a fairly unregulated type activity. But as we developed large professional business structured ski areas, rather than sort of the business of going out, finding a hill, and doing some skiing by yourself, there was a need to join with the larger, more well-developed areas in the country and adopt regulations that in particular define some of the rights and responsibilities both of the operators of ski areas as well as those folks using the ski areas. So the Ski Safety Act attempted to do this, and in fact it put quite a few burdens on the operators of facilities. There's a copy of the Ski Safety Act in your package there, and without going into detail, but it's really put you know, required operators to develop plans for, you know, patrol and safety, how they regulate their tramways, the duties of their operators, the kind of signs that are going to be required, things just simply to make this as reasonably safe an activity as can be, while recognizing their inherent dangers in a aggressive sport. But the bill in also in recognizing the operators had affirmative duties, we look to the skiers also to define and said, you know, skiers participating in these activities have a reasonable and responsible duties themselves. And the primary area of those was simply, you know, recognizing that a skier, and I quote from the Act, is responsible for knowing the range of his own ability. And then the ski area manager is responsible for, you know, the general safe operations of the facility. But there were a number of particular, if you want to call it offenses, that were believed in dangers that the original drafters of the Ski Safety Act wanted to indicate were presented a sufficient danger that they wanted to be able to have a the ability to have a fine for a citation for those offenses, and that they, with having some kind of a monetary deterrent, that it would give the operators the ability to, say, perhaps discourage inappropriate and unsafe behavior to a degree that simply a sign there saying, please don't, would not discourage. So I want to emphasize the bill before us in no way changes any of these aspects of the Ski Safety Act. It's here specifically to clear up two problems that have arisen as the Act has been implemented and developed. And one is, and I want to tell you folks that if just this is one of those bills that doesn't read well. You take a look at the text, and it's fairly difficult to understand without really going into the context. I have to apologize for that, but legislative drafting says we don't put context around bills. The first section really makes a change that eliminates this tagline that said that these violations, a person committing certain violations is guilty of that, or violates a provision of certain sections is guilty of a violation. The commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources shall authorize people to issue these citations. But it has a tagline, and it says, within a ski area over which the state has jurisdiction. Now, that's become an item of some confusion. As we've had a couple of changes in administration since 1994 here in people in the Department of Natural Resources, and then the ski industry itself. And as I've talked with members of the ski industry, their interpretation of that original provision was that that was there to distinguish federal from state jurisdiction, as opposed to that the state was not trying to pass laws or regulations that would be trying to regulate federal land, federal operations, which we could not do. And they wanted to include within state jurisdiction, it's sort of like, you know, saying who has the primary law enforcement jurisdiction over the area. That would include both areas operated by the state itself, as well as private operations operating within the state in an area that's under state jurisdiction.
Well, but even there, police power jurisdiction applies on federal property unless it's otherwise provided. So.
And again, as I, Senator Seekins, again, talking, there was some, again, question here. This seemed to be the issue that was at issue. Who had what jurisdiction where?
So to clarify it, you just struck that point.
We strike that with, and I want to emphasize, I have to emphasize also, this bill enjoys the strong support of both the Department of Natural Resources and the ski industry in the state. But the ski industry and the DNR want to make it very clear that it is any ski area, not just one operated by the state of Alaska.
So now it's implied that those areas which are under state police power jurisdiction, this bill applies to.
That would be, yes, sir, that would be very correct. So that's the first paragraph, the first change. The second was the original Ski Safety Act in 1994 contemplated that the Supreme Court would establish a bail forfeiture schedule for those violations specified in the section referenced in the bill here, which in the sponsor statement I've attached an addendum to that, where these are specific items in section 0545-100 that were identified within the bill as being those activities that a person could do that we wanted to discourage with the greatest possible deterrence. You'll find that in the very end of the package, there is a letter from the Eagle Crest Ski Area, which summarizes, and it's page 2, the bail schedule that had been proposed by the DNR back in 1994. And it basically moves the schedule of fees for these violations from $50 to $150 for several of the violations. I want to emphasize that none of these violations for which a bail forfeiture schedule was contemplated have anything to do with judgmental calls on a skier's ability to ski. These are not speeding tickets for skiing too fast. This is not giving the ski patrol the ability to go out there and essentially be a police force on the ski slope. But these are fairly objective items that are very objectively determined. Having a collision, leaving someone injured, skiing in a closed area, skiing riding lifts under the influence of drugs and alcohol, certainly crossing the track of an uphill lift, using skis without stopping devices, I could see something that could become a missile going downhill, and skiing in a closed area. The Supreme Court has also in your package a two letters that are particularly succinct about this, and their statement was just quite simply that the Supreme Court does not believe there is clear authorization in statute to establish this bail schedule. So Section 2 gives very clear and succinct direction to establish this bail forfeiture schedule. And again, it's simply the Supreme Court shall establish by rule or order a schedule of bail amounts which may be forfeited without a court appearance for a violation of C or G. The third section follows up this that point of without a court appearance. I mean, this is not criminal activity. This is something we just want to discourage. The penalty is only these offenses are classified as violations, which are punishable only by a small fine. The third section of the bill goes to the point of law where these sort of issues are dealt with, and this is Alaska Statute Section 1225, 180, and 90, which are really part of the arrest and citation section of the Code of Criminal Procedure, where we specifically exempt any citation issued under the Ski Safety Act from having the requirement that an individual appear in person, should they forfeit their bail on this. Other areas of citations where we've got bail schedules in the state that are similar are motor vehicle citations with a bail fine schedule, fish and game violations with a bail schedule. Obviously, the proposal is to add the Ski Safety Act. And we've also got the parks and recreational facilities, and like I say, littering citations, and somewhere in here, which I've gotten past, I know is also the Boating Safety Act citations. That third section, again, it specifically is saying that when you issue a citation here, the citation does not have to have a written promise to appear in court, since it's at best addressed only by a fine if offered. And we do have available today to present both the Department of Natural Resources and representatives of the Alaska ski industry, should you wish to query them any, sir.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator French.
Chairman, good morning. Representative Hawker, how are you this morning?
Senator, good to see you, sir.
The sponsor statement that I have on page 2 says that without a bail schedule, the fine for all violations specified is $50 for each offense. Do I take that to mean that currently the ski industry could be issuing citations for $50 for each of these offenses if they wanted to?
Well, through the chair, Senator French, recognizing I'm speaking with a member of the bar who has been a prosecutor, I have to be very cautious, as I am not a member of the bar, or particularly, but it is
don't,
my...
Don't be cautious, Representative Hawker. I didn't do much work in this area.
It is my understanding that under the existing structure that the violation may be of these... the violation schedule are punishable today by a $50 violation.
And so the real... what we're doing here today is establishing a higher...
Allowing the Supreme Court. We would not be establishing the bail schedule, but we would be authorizing the Supreme Court to establish that schedule. Yes?
Alaska State Supreme Court.
And so that kind of brings me to my next question, which is the bail schedules that I see in some of the, in the sport packet. I think you referenced this one from Eagle Crest Ski Area. These are suggestions that the Supreme Court would look at as far as they're setting the schedule. They can set it wherever they want.
Through the chair, Senator French, that would be my understanding. The schedule here was the schedule that was proposed by the ski industry by the Division of Natural Department of Natural Resources to the Supreme Court for adoption back in 1994, when the court said, well, we don't have authority to adopt anything. So yes, this was what was offered by the department to the Supreme Court.
Because my concern is that right now you can cite anybody for a $50 violation. You're also going to pull their ticket if you catch them doing one of these misdeeds. So it's the ticket plus the $50, is in statute right now, and frankly, that kind of strikes me as being plenty of penalty for most of these issues. I might reconsider on like skier involved in a collision, leaving the scene of an accident. That's pretty egregious, but skiing on a closed slope or trail, and you duck underneath a little piece of nylon rope, you ski a couple of turns, and you duck underneath it at the bottom of the run. That doesn't strike me as being $150 worth of wrongdoing. So I guess I'm quibbling over the numbers, and that's maybe my quibble with someone besides yourself.
I don't know if that's mandatory, but it could be. I don't think those are mandatory penalties. Those are ceilings. I understand how a bail schedule works. At least, looking at bail schedules, I see so many of them suspended, or what do they call them? Suspended impositions of sentence based on not the incident not reoccurring. And I would imagine, and I'm not talking for the court, but a judge that could say, well, it's $50, or young man or young lady, the next time it happens, if it happens again, we're going to impose the remainder of this sentence plus another $150. There might be some more incentive for them not to do so.
Before we get too far afield, I'm not sure you can do that in the context of this kind of a citation.
I think they're trying to get to a point where there is a meaningful penalty. And I don't know, to someone who's not a good skier, who never was allowed to ski because my coaches would have killed me if I hadn't broken a leg. I can see how some of these activities are very dangerous to other people around them. Deliberately skiing in a closed area, even to members of the ski patrol who may have to be the ones to risk their well-being to go in there and rescue someone who's been injured. So, I'm wondering exactly, I understand what you're saying, Senator French, somebody who quickly darts underneath the fence at the very last time. It may not be a very serious offense, but if we don't have some kind of teeth in the rules, and in effect the people are barred from the ski area for the day, and that's about it, their ticket is pulled for the day, what's to keep them from continuing bad behavior? That's where I look at the proposal, and I don't know if that's the intent of the sponsor or not.
Chairman, actually, your analysis there is very much right on point. In effect, the letter from Commissioner Irwin here in the second paragraph also indicates the support for Senator Seekin's analysis there, that it's the staff and ski managers are, there's particular concerns with these violation of closed areas and boundaries, and it says just a fine sufficient to discourage the dangerous behavior, and the danger is perhaps not even to the skier themselves, but to the folks that, an area may be closed for an avalanche issue or something, that you could be exposing a great number of other people to injury as a consequence of the violation if they have to go in for a rescue or some other activity. It's also, you may close an area for maintenance and grooming type activities. Again, a machine operator they do not have a primary duty to be looking for the skier. So it's also to provide, just as a higher level of deterrent in a fairly vague world for bit of a specific act.
And I think in that regard, I don't have a problem leaving, since it's $150 maximum, seems like here, that to the discretion of the court as to the severity of the case, or to the question I have, when I get down to it, is when I look at the bill, the definition of peace officer. Senator Hawker,
sir.
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, that is one of those points where the language of the bill is, as you have to look and read what's in front of you, is a bit confusing, because again, that section of peace officers are not involved in this activity of within the Ski Safety Act. It's ski area operators and the Department of Natural Resources. This section, if you notice, it moves into Alaska Statute Section 12, which is the Code of Criminal Procedure, and this is generically a section excluding certain citations from having this mandatory requirement to appear. In this context, the word peace officer, which is typically the paragraph is prefaced by, if you indulge me, letting me cite from the paragraph here, that a person cited for the crime shall give a written promise to appear in court by signing at least one copy of a written citation prepared by the peace officer. That is the general rule when, in this state, someone has committed a crime and is being cited by a police officer for it. Then the next paragraph is where it becomes operative, and that is the written promise requirement does not apply to boating citations and all the rest of these. It perhaps, if the implication that it involves a requirement that a peace officer issue the citation is, again, perhaps it's a bit vague, but it is not contemplated nor required under the Ski Safety Act. This is strictly, a violation activity managed by folks, by the Department of Natural Resources and folks designated by the commissioner to be part of the process. It is, again, not involving peace officers.
I needed to have that on the record. I had several inquiries on that, and I wanted to have that that explanation on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, and I appreciate the chance to put that on the record, because it is a very important distinction to make.
So if I understand this correctly, your intent is to try to give a more serious deterrent to those people that knowingly put the life and safety of other individuals at stake through their bad practices on ski slopes.
Senator Seekins.
Whether they're on snowboards or skis.
That would be correct, Senator Seekins, and within the larger context of promoting the development of a vital, vibrant downhill ski industry in this state.
Additional questions for Representative Hawker. Thank you, Senator Ogun.
What about places like Hatcher Pass, where it's state park, there's no organized, there's not a ski operator up there, but kids are running up and down there with trucks and dropping people off, and then a lot of them are hiking up to the tops and skiing down, and they're getting exposed to, and there's also high marking goes on with snow machiners, and then we get the expense of digging the bodies out and looking for the bodies and put everybody into harm's way and that kind of stuff. And there's probably times when they shouldn't be high marking. Just for the record, high marking is seeing who can get the highest mark on the mountain with a snow machine track. It's the sport de jour of the snow machiners these days. Do they even have authority to do this stuff?
Through the chair, Senator Ogun. Another outstanding question, and I sincerely appreciate the chance to put it on the record, but the definition section of the Ski Safety Act, which is Code Section 0545-200, specifically provides that a ski area, and earlier in the legislation, this applies only to a ski area within this definition or a ski area operator. A ski area means downhill ski slopes, trails, or places under the control of a downhill ski area operator, and specifically a ski area does not include a cross-country ski trail. It would not be cross-country, even if it is under a controlled area, and a ski area operator is a person having operational responsibility for a downhill ski area and includes an agency of the state or a political subdivision. Emphasize that clearly this bill does not in any way affect open land that is not commercially developed as a downhill ski area.
Okay. Although Senator Ogun and I do agree that there should be some penalty for putting lives and safety in jeopardy through some other practices. Go ahead.
We don't have the resources anymore, Mr. Chairman, for avalanche forecasting and that type of thing. We don't fund that in the state budget anymore. Although it seemed to me that were I the director of the state parks, I'd hire an avalanche expert as one of my park rangers and give him, especially in the winter time in some of the park areas, give him the authority to, or the resources necessary to go out and make the analysis and then maybe. I think it'd be good if we could modify this bill to allow state parks to close some of these things. You know, Chief Guest State Park especially, and up there in the Hatcher Pass area, and where there's real hazardous conditions, and you have these yagos out there being stupid. Every time there's one of these avalanches or somebody's in them, you know, it puts 50 people at risk trying to find that person, you know, subsequent avalanches. And the conditions are bad, they're causing avalanches, they're putting people out in search and rescue situations in bad conditions and exposing these people to life-threatening things. So I think we should really look at it. It's a serious problem. It's probably more serious than some hot dogger on a snowboard in a ski area getting too much air, which my son will probably get a ticket for.
Larry, thank you. Other questions for Representative Hawker? We have Larry Daniels online on the off-net. Mr. Daniels, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you'll introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Daniels, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Okay. My name is Larry Daniels. I am the Ski Area General Manager for Alyeska Resort. Chairman Seekins and members of the committee, I'd like to go on record as supporting House Bill 188. 188 simply completes the 1994 Skier Safety Act that, as it was originally contemplated to operate. That bill has been a very good bill over the years. It specifies both the skiers' responsibilities as well as spends a great deal of time identifying the ski area's responsibilities. 188 put some enforcement power into the act, the Skier Safety Act. I liken our current situation to one where if on the highways of Alaska we had our speed limits but had no ability for the troopers to enforce that. That's somewhat the situation we are in right now. In answer to at least one of the comments, I think, from Senator French, we have areas such as the North Face that is underneath our tramway, which are some of our most challenging slopes and the parts of the mountain that people very much enjoy. But at times, those slopes must be closed because they are potentially very prone to avalanche or very dangerous. And not having them, we currently have some problems with this now where people disregard our very obvious closed signs and enter that area, placing not only our own staff in jeopardy if they are in the process of doing avalanche control, but if we need to rescue them, put them also in danger. Some of the other issues are particularly from the collision issue, whereby not having any significant deterrent does not allow us to adequately deter people from reckless behavior, putting other people at risk. So we feel that what this act will do will finally provide that deterrence, just like slowing down when you see that trooper car alongside the road, that people will think it's somewhat doctor over the years and the number of current citations that are issued. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, if you'd put yourself on the record this morning, we'll hear your testimony as well.
Good morning, Senator. I'm David Wilson, Mountain Manager for Alyeska Resort. Over the last 3 years from keeping records, we have actually seen a decrease in the number of total violations that we have given out. Now, of these total violations, we have four that we consider serious, which would be collision, jumping from a chairlift, ticket fraud, and skiing in a closed area. By far, skiing in a closed area is the biggest percentage of violations that we issue. But through education and somewhat of the deterrent of citations, these numbers have gone down pretty well. The number of citations has also gone down. In 2000-2001 season, we issued, or Department of Natural Resources issued 5 citations. And in 2001-2002, 1 citation was issued. So contrary to some of those that think that Ski Patrol is just going to go out there and start issuing citations, that is not the case. We use this as a deterrent, and Department of Natural Resources, if it's serious enough, will issue that citation, and hopefully people will get the message. Thank you.
Questions for either the gentleman, Senator French.
Just to make clear, hi, Mr. Wilson, it's Hollis French here in Juneau. Just to, so I understand, you have the authority right now to issue citations. Is that right?
Yes. We will give a violation, notify DNR, who in turn will issue the citation. The ski area does not directly issue the citation.
However, this bill, the way I read it, envisions at least allowing the ski area operator to pick folks to be able to issue citations. Is that something you have talked about?
If I may answer this, this is Larry Daniels. The intent would be that our staff would not directly issue the citation. We would make a recommendation to the Department of Natural Resources, and they in turn would make a determination as to whether to issue a citation.
And I think, Senator French, you're probably right in that the bill says or an employee here that a person designated by the ski area operator is authorized by the commissioner. It still would require the commissioner to authorize the individual, but Representative Hawker?
If I might, Chairman Seekins, want to remind us that this language that we're discussing is in current statute. It's not new statute being provided by the bill. So this is the currently operative statute, and as we can see, the interpretation of statute currently is the mechanism described by Mr. Daniels, sir.
Thank you.
And just last question, just so I'm clear, and the citations issued now carry a maximum penalty of $50. Is that right?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions for either of the gentlemen? Hearing none, do we have anyone else online? Anyone in the audience? What? We have DNR to answer questions. Are there any questions for the members of the people at DNR? Seeing none. Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? See no one there. So we'll close public testimony. Is there further discussion or questions for Representative Hawker?
Chairman.
Senator Ogan.
Just that I think that we should work on giving the state parks the authority to fill some areas and some more authority to write tickets for people that that violate those closures and risk other people's lives through irresponsible behavior. And we might be able to get a little bit better handle up there in Hatcher's Pass. It's a big deal. I mean, I've you know, been involved in constituents that have lost loved ones in the avalanches, and we're trying to get special equipment out there to find, you know, the victims, and it's a huge problem. I think we have a vehicle here we could possibly address it with.
We do have a vehicle that would require a title change. What's the next committee of referral? Does it have finance committee referral?
State affairs, I believe.
Not through the chair, I believe this is, at here it is, referred to rules.
This is a final other than rules. I'm wondering, we might have to have a title change in order to accommodate that. This specifically works on a particular existing legislation. I agree with you that this is worthwhile. I don't know what problems that might cause for it if it went into conference or if there would be concurrence. I'd hate to hold up a good bill with unintended consequences, but
well, it's close to rules.
Yeah.
Senator Ogden?
Mr. Chairman, I would only want to do it if the bill sponsor was willing to work on it. I mean, I'm busy, he's busy, we're all busy. And
so I'm a little concerned about is our schedules over the next two weeks and 2 days.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would take a title change. The title seems to be broad enough. The authority of the Department of Natural Resources to issue citations for certain ski violations. We might have to change it.
If you're trying to get into snow machines, it would.
Yeah, probably.
That's why that's only my only concern is, which would probably increase the intensity of the discussion a little bit. I would defer to the members of the committee. I have no problem with this going forward the way it is and working on separate legislation in the next session to be able to accomplish some of those safety concerns as they relate to other uses in public lands. I would defer here to the members of the committee and to the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, certainly I believe Senator Ogden raises very, very legitimate concerns on certain activities, but I would ask that the committee consider that this bill, as it's been intended from the very beginning, was specifically to be focusing on skiing within organized areas, specifically those issues to do with the Ski Safety Act of 1994. And while I very much would concur that other areas and authority for the department, we have not even contemplated or looked into any of the other existing statute that may or may not already be in effect for those matters. And again, from a simplicity standpoint, as well as keeping this bill as it was intended through the process, I'd be greatly appreciative of the committee if we would consider not amending it into areas of mechanized sports from the, again, the organized downhill skiing focus that it has been brought forth with.
Discussion?
Okay.
Senator, thank you. I think we might really, I would imagine if and when we do address some of the operating safety concerns for mechanized vehicles that we're going to have a great deal of public input on both sides of that issue. So I don't want to burden this bill with that discussion at this late point. It might appear to some people as if we're trying to sneak something in under the cover of darkness that didn't have adequate public debate, as this bill certainly has had as it worked its way through both the House and now the Senate. So I'd be a little nervous about that. Any further discussion by the members?
I'll just say, Mr. Chairman, that from what I heard from the ski area folks, they issued 5 citations 1 year and 1 citation the following year. It seems like this is, and no disrespect to Representative Hawker, he's one of the hardest working people in this building. He does not waste a lot of time. He's probably been at work here for several hours already this morning. But it seems like what they're trying to do is just simply increase the fines for some violations that aren't really a problem. And so I'm lukewarm at best on this bill. Alyeska serves thousands and thousands of skiers every year. If they have 5 citations in 1 year and 1 citation the next, it strikes me that there's no real problem down there looking to be fixed. So my feeling is that system's working pretty well just right now without having to jack up the fines on folks who are outside trying to get some exercise and enjoy a little bit of athletic activity.
Okay, we'll just go off the record for a moment. I'm going to carry the bill over so that the entire membership of the committee will be able to consider it, and we'll work with the Representative Hawker, the sponsor, to get this back on the schedule quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do appreciate it in the indulgence of the committee this morning.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you,
Let's
sir.
Let's move on to House Bill 25. Representative Wyrock, welcome to the Judiciary Committee this morning. This is a pretty comprehensive bill, and we're eager to hear your introduction of it this morning.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Wyrock, a representative from House District 4. And Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, I'd like to introduce the bill. And then I know there's people that have taken time off from work. If we could go from testimony specifically to Mr. Malley online, and Ms. Wallington, or Dr. Wallington, and then the audience. And then, Mr. Chairman, I left a committee, State Affairs chairing, to come up here. So I don't mean disrespect, but I'll probably go back there.
We have no problem with that, Representative Wyrock. We're going to dismiss at 9:30 today as well because we have some commitments that have to be met. So if you'll go right ahead and we'll begin the discussion however you like, and there's no disrespect for you to do your job here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 25 was pre-filed in 2002, and it had roughly six hearings in House Health and Social Services, and then four hearings in House Judiciary. And then over here, Chair Dyson of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee had, I think, roughly eight hearings, and it's gone through substantial revision in the Senate. And I owe a great deal of respect and appreciation to Senator Dyson for what that committee did on this bill in conjunction with our office. This bill is a significant piece of legislation in that it brings together programs that deal with organ donation, living will program, the Comfort One, do not resuscitate provisions of statute, the durable powers of attorneys, and advanced directives for health care decisions. Death is a necessary part of life. It's a critical part of life, and we all die. This bill is intended to provide in one place the information available to people who are dying and whose families are dying and who want to plan for their deaths when that time comes. It's intended to help clarify existing law and to bring other good portions of laws throughout the United States into one law here in Alaska. And it's garnered a great deal of attention and interest from a multitude of parties that are interested in clarifying the statutes on these issues and allowing the public who needs to deal with these in hospitals, hospices, medical providers, a clear standard to deal with end-of-life health care decisions. And the bill was gathered my interest because of my father, who recently passed away, and he had a durable power of attorney and advanced health care directives, but he didn't advise my mother of them. Therefore, he languished in a state where he did not want to be for 3 years before he actually passed away. And when my mother was advised of the situation, she was, you know, upset because he was living a life that he never would have wanted. And if his advanced health care directives had been simply acted upon, he would not have, he would have been treated a lot differently in terms of his medical health care decisions. And so this is something that all people can use, and Mr. Chairman, it is a meaty bill, and I want the committee comfortable with it as the other committees have been when they've passed it out. And so what I was planning to do is just step back and let a lot of other people testify who've had input in these.
Any questions at this point for Representative Wyrock? Senator Ogun.
Representative Wyrock, I'm sorry. I think this bill, and I'm looking for it, has a section that deals with the do not resuscitate order from another state is effective in Alaska. And how's someone to know? I mean, say we have somebody up here from gets off a cruise ship here in Juneau or visiting a relative or whatever. I mean, some of the criticism I've heard of the bills is what if someone resuscitates and later finds out, you know, there's an existing order in another state? I mean, how are you supposed to know that? And then, I mean, I would suspect most do not resuscitate orders are probably terminally ill patients or very ill patients that are in hospitals and, you know, they're at the end of their life and either the family or they have made decision to resuscitate, but anyway, maybe we could.
Sure. Senator, through the chair, Again, if we could get the testimony from the hospital, particularly Dr. Wallington, how they deal with this, and then I didn't anticipate you moving this bill today, and we can deal with this question. Right.
Okay, we can do that. Senator Ogun?
Thank you. And maybe you could explain the page 10 of the bill, the do not resuscitate protocol, identification requirements. And maybe I'm not connected to DOS, but it just says an attending physician may issue a do not resuscitate order for a patient of the physician. And I'm assuming, I would hope that there's some form of some form other than just the doctor's discretion with this. And I think there is, but
Dr. Wallington with the hospital, okay. Providence can address that.
Good. We'll give you the opportunity, Sir Representative Reiner, because we put these questions together, as you said, to give a seriatim a discussion of them at a later point, since you are chairing another committee. And we appreciate your work over there and the good work that you do. So
these kind of questions are important to come out. I want it clear for the record and everybody comfortable.
Yep. Well, we will go through them and try to present that for you as a sponsor as a courtesy. We know that your calendar is tight as well. Appreciate it. And we'll get started with those folks. Hopefully they heard that question, and we'll start using Dr. Wallington as a first level responder for some of these questions of the members. How's that? Does that help you out, Senator Ogun? Thank you. Let's get started first, and we have a number of people that have indicated they want to testify on this bill, and Representative Weirach, the sponsor, has mentioned Dr. Marie Wallington. Dr. Wallington, are you there with us this morning?
Yes, sir, I am.
If you would put yourself on the record, we'd like to hear your opening remarks, and we may have some questions for you.
Certainly. I'm Dr. Maria Wallington. I have history of working about 25 years in pediatric cardiology and the last 4 or 5 years in ethics. I'm currently the medical ethicist for the Providence Health System in Alaska. I've had the privilege of working extensively with the Senate Health Committee and the sponsor and his staff on this bill. And many of the questions you're starting to raise have been raised before, and we've talked about them extensively. First of all, to mention the one about a visitor coming to the state. In general, when someone has signed up for an out-of-hospital do not resuscitate situation or order, they have some kind of identification with them. That's true in our state with our Comfort One program. The EMT system here, the hospital system here, is informed by this statute and our prior statutes, that if they see those identifications, if they can verify that the person actually has a do not resuscitate order, then they are relieved from the responsibility of providing resuscitation from anybody who is in need. In our own state, if you don't have your identification with you, you will be resuscitated. And so it's not a situation where, gee, the information is out of state someplace else, and what you do. If that's the case, then we resuscitate and make decisions after the fact if the person survives the resuscitation and get further information.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Ogun? You had a couple others.
No, I don't think so at this time. Maybe just kind of outline. You know, this time of year, I've got to confess that we're swamped with paperwork and bills, and there's not enough hours in the day to be as prepared as we would like. Could you highlight some of the issues that were hot button issues in other committee hearings on, and maybe point out the sections or the pages of the bill where we could bring those to our attention?
This is Dr. Wallington. I wasn't clear. Are you addressing me?
Yes, ma'am.
The other person who's dealt very extensively with all the revisions is Representative Weirach's staff, Linda Sylvester, and she may be able to help me better with finding the page numbers if she's there.
why don't we do this? I know that Representative Wyrock's staff has indicated that Paul Malley from With Aging with Dignity in Florida has some introductory remarks that may be beneficial for us and on the Five Wishes movement. So if you would accommodate me, Dr. Wellington, I'd like to ask Paul Malley, if he's online, if he would introduce himself and provide us with his prepared remarks this morning.
I would. Thank you, Chairman. I appreciate it. My name is Paul Malley, and I'm president of Aging with Dignity, which is a national nonprofit organization based in Florida. We work throughout the country with the mission of advocating for quality care at the end of life. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning and bring greetings from the Sunshine State. By way of background, we were founded in 1996 by a man named Jim Tuohy, and Jim was legal counsel to Mother Teresa of Calcutta, so he did all of her legal work and also worked in some of her homes for the dying in Calcutta and in Washington and in Mexico. And I mention that because that was his motivation for founding Aging with Dignity and for putting the emphasis on caring for those who are at the end of life with in a way that maintains their human dignity. Mr. Tuohy was also secretary of Florida's Social Services Agency under Governor Lawton Childs, and currently he directs the White House Office on Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. So I succeeded him after he moved on to the position at the White House. But I've been here at Aging with Dignity for 6 years, so I'm pretty well familiar with the Five Wishes document specifically and what's happening with this document on the national level and the good things that it's bringing about in promoting good quality care at the end of life. And that's what I just want to share with you briefly today, highlight some of the things that are happening nationally that would have the opportunity to be replicated in Alaska if legislation such as that's proposed now passes. Briefly on the document of Five Wishes itself, we had three goals when we developed it. Number one, we wanted to make a document that was very clear and easy to understand and easy to use, because we heard from so many people that if they had legal or medical documents that they couldn't understand, obviously they were reluctant to fill them out. Second, we wanted to include more than just medical issues in this advanced care planning conversation, because when people are asked about what's important to them at the end of life, they most commonly say things like, I want to be in my home, and I want my family to be with me. I don't want to be in pain. I want people praying for me or praying with me. These types of things, along with their preferences for life support treatment. So we included those personal, emotional, and spiritual elements in this document. And that's why I believe it's really struck a nerve, because it's easy to use, and it puts the conversation, it puts the document in terms that are meaningful for people and that they can understand. Although the popularity of Five Wishes has grown rapidly, we've distributed about 3 million copies across the country. There are 6,000 organizations like hospitals and hospices, even employers that are giving it out to their employees. In fact, here in Florida, we've been grateful for the support of Governor Jeb Bush, who has given Five Wishes to all employees of the state of Florida, which is wonderful. However, there are a few roadblocks remaining on the national level. In 15 states, including Alaska, there are currently requirements for what we would call a mandatory form. So there's a form spelled out in the state statute, and there's not a whole lot of wiggle room for people to put these personal wishes in their own words. And that can be a barrier to a document like Five Wishes or any other document that people can see makes sense and that would inspire them to make these plans and have the discussion. And it's my understanding that the intent of this legislation that you're considering makes this whole process much more streamlined and much more effective by putting all of the requirements for durable powers of attorney for healthcare, living wills, organ donation, and others all under one umbrella. That in itself makes it easy. It also makes it easier for people of Alaska to put their wishes in their own words, whether it be in a Five Wishes document or another document, while still saying here there are some requirements, like that it still needs to be witnessed and things like that, which are built into the Five Wishes document. And when we wrote it, we had the help of the American Bar Association to make sure that it met all the legal requirements in as many states as possible. Just before I close, I just want to share with you one brief example of why this topic is so important and what it can bring about. I met a woman in Massachusetts, and she came up to me after a presentation, and she said that day had marked the one-year anniversary of her husband's death. And she said that for some reason he had filled out the Five Wishes document a year before he had a stroke. He was healthy, he was in his mid-60s, had no reason to think that something was going to happen. But when he had a stroke, he spent the last 28 days of his life in a coma and in the hospital. and she kept the five wishes document on his bedstand in the hospital. And she said, you know, I've never cared for a sick husband before, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to care for him. I wanted to do the best things, but I didn't know what the best things were. And five wishes helped me to do that, because in his five wishes, he had written things like he wanted to have pictures of his grandchildren in the room with him, that he wanted to have his favorite Afghan that his wife had made for him brought to him. And she said, I can't tell you how good it felt to get in the car and go home and bring him those things. And she said, when any doctor or nurse walked into the room and they picked up his document and they flipped through it, she said, I don't care if they looked at it for 30 seconds. I felt like they knew him better than when they first walked in the door, and that meant a lot to me. After the 28 days passed and the doctor said that it was very unlikely that he would recover, she made the decision to remove the life support treatment. And that day, a son who had been estranged from the family flew in from out of town and said, absolutely not, we can't make this decision. We can't do that because if we remove the life support treatment, Dad might die. And the family was thrown into chaos for a few minutes, and the mother brought out this five wishes document, and she showed it to her son, and her son looked at it, and she said the thing that drove the point home to him was when he turned to the back page and saw his dad's signature. And he said, this was Dad's decision to make, and he made it, so we need to honor it. So that instance where it could have been just an awful, chaotic situation at a time when no family needs it was avoided. And lastly, this family had another benefit in that when the father had filled out five wishes, there's one bullet point there that says, I wish for my family to make peace with each other if that's possible before my death. And she said, you know, it didn't happen before he died, but my two sons who hadn't spoken in 5 years spoke on the day that their father died for the first time, and they've been great friends ever since. And it was because, you know, my husband gave this gift to our family. So I share that with you just to say that when we're having this conversation about advanced care planning, these are the types of real issues and relationship issues that we're really talking about, and that by making the whole process easier and by removing some of the barriers in Alaska, you're making it easier for the people of Alaska to make their wishes known so that they can have these peaceful, dignified deaths and the care at the end of life that's so important to all of us and that I think we can all agree on. So I commend you and your efforts, especially Representative Wyrock and his staff that's worked so hard on this and encourage you in the effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wellington. Ms. Malley. So please, Senator Ogun, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Senator Scott Ogun. I had the misfortune of having a full cardiac arrest heart attack. And if I had one of these in place, I probably wouldn't be here right now because the reports of the doctors were very pessimistic and my prognosis was not good. You know, they told my wife if I'd made it through the night, which they didn't expect me to, probably would be brain dead because I was took so long to resuscitate me, and of course some people might think I'm brain dead anyway, but especially if it's a bunch of new. But these things are aren't absolutes, you know, and if you have these absolute orders, you know, if this looks like this and that looks like that, then, you know, or if you're not resuscitated or whatever. And by golly, I'm glad they resuscitated me, you know, and my family is too. And didn't have any brain damage, although, like I said, some people might question that. So there's some things in here that kind of raise a red flag to me on, it's page 22 of the bill, but it's...
And we have been forwarded version Z for Zulu, and I imagine
it's under the durable power of attorney health care decisions, and it's
well, that's on page what?
It's page 22 of the bill, and it says it talks about being issued relief from pain. I direct it to that treatment to alleviate pain or discomfort should be provided, even if it hastens my death. And
which line is that? I'm sorry.
It's on page 22.
And you've got Zebra?
Oh, man. Let's see. I think I might be in the wrong version. I think I am.
Zebra is the copy we were provided, so that is our working document.
All right.
The Chair, Senator Ogun, the version Z, the language you're speaking to is on page 30.
What section?
It's in the, excuse me for the record, I'm Linda Sylvester, staff to Representative Weirach. Senator Ogun is referring to the optional form on page 30. Towards the end of the form, on line 28, there's an option where an individual is given their an opportunity to state their wishes and intentions with pain. And the current language says, following a checkoff, I direct that adequate treatment be provided at all times for the sole purpose of the alleviation of pain or discomfort. And then in the alternative, or, and then the individual would have an opportunity to state their other intentions.
Or I give these instructions, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was in a previous version of the bill, and that's been amended out, which is a good thing.
Okay.
Senator Seekins, also Dr. Wallington might have comments about Senator Ogun's personal situation. That is a concern regarding a do not resuscitate order and how that is appropriately used, and whether that it would have applied to Senator Ogun's health crisis.
You want to address that?
Yeah, Dr. Ogun? Wallington, if I might, you know, I think you probably heard me talking about it, and my experience was, I think I've had more experience than I care for, even though it's been a fantastic experience with the medical community here in the last year or two and a couple of years. And I find that doctors tend to be fairly pessimistic, you know. And I mean, I'm sure they get a little bit jaded. They see a lot of things based on certain experiences, you know, don't look good. And I don't know. I guess if one of these things was in place, if I had signed one of these things where I had this artifact that I had no idea I was going to have, I wouldn't be here today. You deal a lot with the ethics of the medical community. What do you have to say about that?
Are you there, Dr. Wallington?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear Senator Ogun's question?
Yes, I did. It's hard for me to know for sure when you're addressing me. I'm sorry.
Right.
I want to go back to the example he gave of himself. The fact that you have signed an advance directive does not mean you have agreed to be not resuscitate and have gone through the process of having a doctor write the order and gotten the identification. Until the point that you are truly a candidate for do not resuscitate, the fact that you have signed a living will is irrelevant. The doctor needs to be sure that they know your medical situation and they have assessed it and they know that indeed they can't keep you alive. Then they might consider writing a do not resuscitate, but certainly at the point that you had your arrest, you wouldn't have been a candidate for a do not resuscitate. Resuscitation was appropriate.
And once I was in the hospital, one time I had an arrhythmia, and I told my wife, I think I need some, this is like the first day I woke up after 13 days on a respirator. Told my wife, I think I need more O2 because I started feeling a little lightheaded. And then when I woke up, they were taping the thing onto my chest, you know, the defibrillator. And I kind of popped my eyes open and said, you going to defib me? And they said, no, not now. And so, so I was already in this critical, I was in the cardiac care unit, and I was already under critical care, and I don't know. There's times when, and this is probably the thing that you wrestle with the most ethically, is when you withhold it. I mean, even when the patient says, "Well, I don't want to be resuscitated," that's kind of how I feel. I'd assume, you know, if we knew it was over for me with any cognitive ability, I'd just assume check out. Not a scary place. Been there, done that. But what if just the patient's perceptions aren't necessarily, I guess if once they're dead, you don't know.
We hope that people spend a lot of time thinking about how they want their advance directive to read is so that they will tell us how they want us to decide. You know, if you had had an advance directive that said, always keep going, do whatever is possible for me, then that would have colored the conversation a different plan. So the importance is to use it to express your wishes. So the old form was horrible in that it didn't give any direction. It just said, if I'm dying and you can't stop it, let me go. It didn't give the direction for the situations that are not clear or could go one way or the other. So voiding advance directive because you're afraid somebody won't resuscitate you loses you the opportunity of getting your strong voice out there about where your position is.
We have now run up against the clock. And I apologize, but both Senator Ogun and I have to be at another meeting. That leaves only Senator French, and I'm sure he'd be able to carry on this conversation. But with that, we've looked at our calendar, and our intent is to bring this back up on Thursday. If anyone wishes to bring us any written testimony, we'll be more than anxious. We'll be very eager to see it. And with that, the Judiciary Committee is adjourned.